Cyber Talks. I'm one of your hosts, Tia Hopkins, Field CTO and Chief Cyber Risk Strategist with Decentire. Today, we're going to dive into the topic of democratizing cyber education with Ken Underhill, CEO of CyberLife and cybersecurity industry leader and influencer. Ken is incredibly passionate about his mission to democratize cyber education, which I'm really excited to dig into with him today. Ken, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Tia. It's always a pleasure. It's kind of like getting on the Oprah show whenever I get to interview with you.
Listen, you're the star here. So I'm excited that you joined and really excited about the conversation. So, you know, you and I have known each other for quite some time and collaborated on a number of things to help move the industry forward. But for our listeners, tell us a little about yourself and your background within cybersecurity.
Yeah, so I came from a healthcare background. I was a medic in the military, and you know that period of my life was full of testosterone and beer, and that was pretty much it. And then after that, I became a pediatric nurse for a number of years. I also did adults, cardiology, electrophysiology, hospice nursing, but adults whine all the time. Little kids don't whine all the time, so it was an easy transition to pediatric nursing. And then from there, I was working at this place. The IT team just totally sucked, and I kept having to do like the IT support, and I was like, well, like they're getting paid to do that and I'm not getting, but I'm doing it. That doesn't make any sense. So I went back into the IT realm and worked as a network engineer for a while doing network security, et cetera. And then just, what we call cybersecurity these days, that just kind of happened, you know, it was just part of the job back then. And so I say that to say for anyone listening out there that's looking to get their first job or looking to get a different job in cyber, look up the skills, search by the skills and not by the job title, because that will open up a whole gamut of all sorts of weird job titles, but also opportunities for you out there.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. We definitely don't do ourselves any favors with being clear about what the job is and what it entails. So that's actually a nice segue into my next question here. Let's dive a bit into your goal of democratizing cyber education. So what does that mean to you, and what spurred you to start CyberLife?
Yeah, I mean, so democratizing cybersecurity education, people probably have a lot of different opinions, but really it's just removing those economic barriers. I mean, I grew up as a very poor kid. I've shared that on social media before, and I didn't have the opportunity to go to college. I mean, I got a scholarship, but otherwise college was off my radar. I mean, anything in life was off my radar aside from working in construction at that point in my life. And so, well, that and doing, you know, criminal stuff, which wasn't, I wasn't, you know, jail just didn't seem like the right path for me. So I decided not to do that. But yeah, it's just removing those economic barriers. Now that doesn't mean, I think a lot of people get the misconception that means like everything's free. That's not the case, at least in my opinion, right? Because some things you just have to charge for some things, you know, the quality's there, it's a more senior level topic or whatever, the certification, whatever the case might be. Everyone's got to make money, right? So you might be working with a certification vendor that has minimum fees and as a company, you have to make a profit, things like that. But for that entry level market, the reality is the vast majority of things can be free. There's just no reason to charge people $20,000 for something. So that's really what the democratizing cybersecurity education is about. It's really opening up those economic barriers, because everyone keeps talking about cybersecurity skills gap. We need more people, but then we're like gatekeeping because we're like, well, you need to have, you know, 50 grand to come here and do this. Why? This is just knowledge that back in the day, we just read in books in the library, or we just went and did it. You know, we learned it on the job. So that's really what it is, removing those economic barriers. Now, CyberLife itself actually got started for my TV show to protect the IP on that. And so it was really a media company initially. And then everyone knows me for creating courses over the years. So I just spun up a training division on that. So we do corporate trainings. We also have what's called the CyberLife School, which is really where we're having the impact. That will be the vast majority of courses. In fact, the couple we have on now are free. Everything else is going to be free aside from where we have to charge something for some of the certification ones. But aside from that, everything on there will be free. So I'll say for anyone that's a content creator out there that has courses that they want to put out for free, I'm more than happy to chat with you about putting your courses on our site as well, so you can cross-pollinate a bit, get some free students and whatnot, and get some more brand visibility. But again, only free. I'm not taking anyone that's trying to make a ton of money or anything off the marketplace. It just doesn't make sense. There's other places out there that do that, that have investors and whatnot. For me, I'm self-funded. So, you know, what you see is what you get. And I'm able to control that a little more and actually open up education for more people.
Yeah, I love that, because I'm in a similar boat. I mean, you know, looking at a path to making something of yourself and just seeing financial barrier after financial barrier in the way, it's really discouraging. So I really love the work you're doing, and I admire how much you pour into giving back to the community. And so I think this would be a good time to talk about higher education, right? Because, well, we know that's not free. I remember looking at the degree program saying, well, going to have to pass on that one. But for those that do, you know, sign up to attend these higher ed institutions, are they preparing the next generation of cyber leaders properly? And what they're doing, is it enough?
Well, I think it really depends on the program. There are some good programs in higher ed out there. There are also some very bad programs in higher ed. And I won't say which ones are which on this podcast because we don't want litigation. But yeah, it's you know, I do think there are some programs preparing people very well. And that goes, that's not just for, you know, a lot of people think university level. That's not just that. There's community colleges that have very, very good programs out there that are really preparing people with a lot of good hands-on skills, a lot of the fundamentals, and just reiterating the fundamentals, which really sets them up for success in their career, including soft skills, which I think we'll chat about a little later on. And yeah, I mean, there's bachelor's degrees, master's degree programs, graduate degree programs that are really good. I think the advice I would give is you really have to identify what are your goals, because college degree is not always the right path for you. It might be a boot camp. It might just be getting some certs or just learning on your own or whatever. So you really need to identify what are your goals and then find a program that matches those versus saying, I want to go to Harvard or something, you know, just to go to Harvard. Because I guarantee there's a lot of people with Harvard degrees that are unemployed right now. So it's really just finding out, like, what are your long-term goals? Like, where are you trying to go? And what is the fastest path there? Again, it's not always higher ed, but there are a lot of good higher ed programs out there. The one thing I'll just add on that is, I'm not a big fan of people going into debt to do something, because there's always a free or low cost resource to get your stepping stone to then get into, you know, some job. You don't always need to go, for example, college, $100,000 in debt just to get a job, because there's a lot of college grads that are unemployed. You know, I guess that's a key takeaway for people is certifications, college degrees, boot camp programs, like these things are all great. But nothing is guaranteed to get you a job. The only thing that's really guaranteed to get you a job is hard work, being willing to do the work, to take a role in a company that you don't really want, just to get into the company. And then from there, they can see what you're able to do. And then you have the conversation saying, hey, I would always love to be on the SOC team. Whenever there's an opening, can you let me know? Because I'm doing this, this, and this. And they see how hard you're working within the company. They'll probably create a job for you on the SOC team. Or at least, you know, maybe a hybrid role where you're doing, you know, half your responsibilities here on technical writing or something, and half of them over here on the SOC team. So really, I'm just against people going into debt. I just seen it ruin so many lives. And so if you are thinking about going into a massive debt, make sure it's worth it for what you're trying to do. Don't just collect degrees and certs and stuff, because a lot of people have that and they're still working at McDonald's.
Yeah, I think, you know, what I hear in that is evaluating return on investment is really important, because you can go down the wrong path and just spend tons of money on degrees, tons of money on certifications, and find out they're not applicable to what you want to do, find out they're not in demand anymore. So really evaluating that is important. And I fully agree with you that some universities do a great job of preparing individuals for the workforce versus simply educating them on the theory behind cybersecurity. And some, you know, don't do so great of a job. It's actually why I got into teaching myself. And I tell my students all the time, I'm not here to make sure you get an A. I'm not here to regurgitate to you what's in the textbook. I'm here to make you a meaningful contributor to the cybersecurity industry and tell you what the real world looks like. So as always, we're on the same page there.
I'll just add, Tia, I've heard you are a brutal professor. Like it's almost impossible to get an A in your courses.
Well, listen, if you're going to be a meaningful contributor to the space, then, you know, an A is what it is. But I cannot in good conscience give an A to a student that would not be able to solve a cybersecurity problem, because that's what we're preparing them for at the end of the day, right? Just because you know the definition of malware doesn't mean that you'll be able to respond in the heat of the moment in an organization, right? So I guess, you know, being an educator can be tough because expectations are different in terms of you know, what students are looking to get out of the program or what they're expecting from their professor or instructor. So from your perspective, any war stories from your role as an educator you'd like to share?
Well, the first war story I'll share is actually not mine, but I just giggle every time internally when I think of it. So Kelly Handerhan, I don't know if you know her or not.
Oh yeah.
But Kelly created a lot of the like CISM and CISSP and a lot of CERT courses over on cyber years ago. And I remember she was doing a live, I think it was CISSP training, and like she had ordered food. I think it was pizza. I can't remember exactly what it was, but she ordered food, and like in the midst of training, she gets up like, hang on a second, everybody, and goes and answers the door, and she comes back with like food. And then like she tied it. It was brilliant. She tied the food into the training. I was like, just like, you know, there's certain educators you see out there and you're just like, oh, they're so brilliant. Like, you know, you can tie anything in. I do that a lot with like the general public when I'm teaching people out and about, like my hairstylist recently, teaching them different cybersecurity things. Like I'll just grab a random object and be like, oh, this is like this, blah, 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 you know? And I think that really separates, and not saying I'm the greatest educator, but I think that separates great from good. I think good educators, you know, they can recite things, they can go off experience, things like that. I think if you're a great educator, you can pull off, you can like take anything and explain something you know very well with like candy or whatever, and you can explain it to anyone for them to understand it and get it. And I think that's a differentiator. So I want to bring up Kelly there. I myself, yeah, student expectations. My goodness, we could go for hours on that. I'll just say this. Skill for an educator, in my opinion, are patience and adaptability. I think that, you know, number one, you can't be so rigid where something goes wrong with the technology fails all the time. Like anytime you're doing a live session, like something will go wrong. It's guaranteed. I don't know anyone that's never had an issue with some type of live training. And usually it's labs, which is interesting, but you know, and of course I like, that's the only lab you have that day. And then, you know, you got to figure something else out. But I think adaptability, being able to recognize there's some issue and figuring out, okay, well, what's a backup plan here? How can I use this as an opportunity for learning versus blaming the lab technology or blaming Zoom or, you know, blaming somebody else essentially. Right. And then I think the other thing that I said is patience, because along those same lines, sometimes it'll be reported that there's a lab issue. And I had this happen many times. Oh my gosh, the lab doesn't work. And then, you know, when one person complains, everybody complains. And then when you actually have them share their screen, you see they're typing something in wrong. And you say, oh, you're typing it in wrong. And they're like, they type it again wrong. And they're like, no, see, I'm typing it just like you said. And I'm like, no, like you're typing it wrong, right? So you have to have patience and say, like, you idiot, you know, what are you doing? You have to be like, okay, look, just let's take a moment here. I can screenshot and show you what you're typing if you don't believe or whatever, but like maybe I'm misseeing things, right? Are you, you know, is anyone else seeing what they're typing? Oh yeah, you are typing that wrong, you know, Joe Schmo or whatever. So I really think patience, adaptability are some of the qualities. And yeah, I've got a lot of war stories that are probably not appropriate to share on a public podcast because that would give attribution pretty easily. But I think Kelly's is a good example of an instructor being very adaptable to a situation and blending in something that's going on. Like if you have kids running in the background, screaming that they're going to kill each other, figure out how to tie that into your lesson. You know, be like, hey, sometimes when you're dealing with an incident, people are going to be running around screaming, you know, they're threatening each other or whatever. You've got to be the one remaining calm and focused on what needs to happen. And then pull, you know, getting those people back on track to respond to the incident appropriately. So that's my spiel on that. And hopefully that's enough war stories. If not, we can keep diving in.
No, that's great. And I mean, you know, you talked about patience, you talked about really having the ability to meet learners where they are and make it stick by leveraging real world situations. So you're teeing me up really well for these questions, because what you described are soft skills, right? And so you mentioned earlier we were going to talk about that. So we'll do it now. And I'll just ask, because I talk a lot about emotional intelligence, and a lot of times, you know, technically minded resources don't want to talk about that. Like, what is that? What does that mean? So I want to ask you, do you think the next generation is equipped with the soft skills they need? And if not, what can we do about it?
Well, I'm probably going to get a lot of hate mail for this, but I don't think the vast majority are. And the reason why is because we live in a world of instant gratification now. And so back in the day when, you know, in the ancient days when Tia and I grew up, back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, we actually had to experience life And a lot of things, like, we didn't have Google or anything like that. So we had to, if we wanted to learn something, we had to ask somebody, learn it ourselves, or go to the library. I know there's an ancient thing called the library that people don't really go to anymore. And so we didn't have that instant gratification. And I think that that's led to a few things. Number one, I think it's led to a disconnect on soft skills, because your soft skills are things you really develop in life. Yes, you can take courses, you can do things to help improve them, but really it's life experience that really helps develop those. And the other thing there, I think, with the instant gratification is there's an expectation that you can go in and apply for a job and go into an interview, or even, you know, go to a team and not have to have these things. Like it's like, hey, I'm here. I did a college degree. I did these three certifications. You should hire me no matter what. And it's like, well, no, you're going to suck on the team, right? Like, you're not a good fit for the team because you're a complainer. You don't talk well with, you don't work well with others. You don't, you have your own beliefs and you're firm in those. So you don't accept other cultures or other religions, you know, people from different backgrounds. I can't have you on my team because you're poison. So I think there, yeah, to your question, yes, a long-winded answer, but yeah, I think there's a big disconnect. I think the solution is really just recognizing that you have that issue, you know, that you don't really have these soft skills developed. I think I did a resume session or something, and I was like, you know, people, you know, all of you think like, I think it was maybe on interviews, but I was like, you know, all of you think like your skills are on point, like you're 100%, you know, whatever. And I think it was resumes, because a few people sent me their resume because they were like, my resume looks good. And I tore it up. I was like, no, this is, I was like, you know, good start, but this is terrible. I said, this is like, this shows me no value whatsoever. I don't know what you can do. You know, this is just a laundry list of, you know, keywords. Like, I don't, that doesn't matter. So I think that you as an individual listening to this, you really need to take a step back and say, okay, do I really have these skills that I claim I have? Or are there things, you know, maybe you do, but are there things I can improve? You know, can I improve my communication skills? Can I improve my negotiation skills? Do I find myself getting upset in certain situations? You know, going to what you said, Tia, on EQ, can I work on that? You know, can I maybe meditate more? Can I take some classes on how to best manage my anger and stuff? You know, coming out the military, I had a lot of PTS, or PTS is called nowadays, post-traumatic stress. But PTSD, it was called back in the day. And I had a lot of anger issues, a ton of anger issues. Like, I, you know, somebody cuts you off in traffic, like I go to 10. Immediately, I used to go to 10. And it took a long time to, you know, number one, recognize that, and then work through that to get to the point where I am now, where, I mean, if you cut me off in traffic, I'm still going to curse you, but I'm not where I used to be, right? Like, I'm not going to try to ram you off the road and take you out. So it's, you know, it's really just the starting point is you recognizing that you have gaps. All of us have gaps. I mean, I can improve my communication skills, right? Sometimes I'm ghetto on conversations and stuff like that, but you can always improve these things. It's just recognizing that. And I think to give people a list, because a lot of people are probably like, okay, well, what are these soft skills you're talking about? I think Zanette Kamal, which I know you know, she's phenomenal, yes, by the way, but pick up her books on Amazon, shameless plug. But she actually posted a really good list the other day on LinkedIn, I think it was. So I'm just going to go off her list. And I think, you know, you mentioned EQ as well, which would have been my only addition there. But critical thinking skills, problem solving skills, your communication, so effective communication skills, empathy, right? Being able to really work with people from different backgrounds and empathize with their views on things, because your idea is not always the best. And sometimes we get in our own heads and think it's my way or nothing. Negotiation skills, because everything is sales and marketing in life. So you've got to be able to negotiate for budget, negotiate to get people to do things on a project. People are very well intended in life, but they don't follow through for the vast majority of people. You'll see that in the educator space as well. If you ever have a training company, you want instructors to like build courses. Everyone wants to do it. Very few like actually do it. So it's very interesting. Leadership is another thing she had mentioned. So leadership skills are critical. You don't have to be in a management role to be a leader. I was a leader back when I was working at Burger King. I mean, you know, like you have leadership skills probably already. You just need to recognize that. And if you go into a room and you speak up and people listen, you're a leader. You've got leadership skills. You've already got that because people are listening to you. So they're following you at that point. Adaptability, which we talked about with the instructor thing. I think you have to be adaptable. I mean, cyber changes all the time. I mean, there's things I thought I knew and then it changes, you know, like a month later. And then I think that the last thing I'll add, and I think it was on her list, is curiosity. I think you have to have an innate curiosity. I think also, I'll add this as a soft skill, perseverance, like unstoppable grit. I share the story a lot of when I was growing up, I had to crawl under the rundown trailer under there was like, so I'll share the story. I don't know if you've heard it, Tia, but so basically picture a toddler in your head, like a toddler sized kid, because that's how big I was. I was very short growing up, still a little vertically challenged, but I feel I'm tall. So anyways, we won't go there. But I had to crawl under the rundown trailer that I grew up in. There was this little crawl space. And so in the wintertime, we had this like, it was like basically a paper tube that ran from the one heating vent that worked in the living room area back to the back bedroom area where us little kids slept, where I slept. And without that, you'd have frozen in the winter. Like there was no heat otherwise. And so with this paper tube, I'd skunks and stuff would get in there and like tear it open because it's heat, right? They want to stay warm too. I mean, I don't blame them. It's cold in the winters up there. And so I would have to crawl under this trailer. And it's like, it started out at like maybe like 3 feet or whatever the starting point. And then like there was dirt under there. So like it got narrower and narrower. Like you ended up like, it was like maybe a foot of room to crawl under there. So knowing that, I had to crawl under it all backwards, which doesn't seem so bad, right? It's okay. It's dark, it's damp, whatever, but there were spiders in there. So like you're crawling and the spiders are like actually dropping on your face and stuff. Cause they think you're prey, right? They're like, oh heck yeah, look at this meal. Right. And so the spiders are dropping on you. You're crawling back under there. And a lot of times the skunks were still in there. So then you're trying to, you know, crawl back out quickly. Cause I'd have to crawl under with a roll of duct tape and this flashlight, like the batteries, I swear it was possessed. Cause like the light would work. And then like when you got back in like the far corner where this tube was, where it was very narrow, where the skunks usually were still at. And then you went through all the spiders, the flashlight would click off. Like the lights, I'm like, no. And you'd be shaking and stuff like that. It was just so traumatic as a kid. But I share that story to say that I built unstoppable grit. Cause I had no choice, right? I had to do that. Right. It was life or death. And so I think that if you have grit, perseverance, you know, whatever we want to call it, I think that that's also a soft skill that is really developed in life. And I think a lot of people have that. They just don't recognize it because you've made it this far, right? A lot of people are already dead. They died in childhood or whatever. You're still here. You're watching this. You're listening to this, whatever. So I think you've got that. I think it's, again, going back to what I said earlier, you just have to recognize these skills you already have developed and develop them more. I think as humans, innately, we're born with, it's kind of like a video game, right? You start out with like a certain percentage of whatever, you know, life or whatever. I think Street Fighter used to have life or something, or Mortal Kombat. But you know, I'm really dating myself now. But, you know, you have the life bar or whatever. And so like you start out with a little bit of life, you know, think of that as your soft skills. And as you get through the levels or whatever, you increase that, right? And you end up wherever you're at. So just focus on the fact you need to improve that, those soft skills, and just keep, you know, keep increasing your life so you can keep winning at the game of life.
I like that. There were, I mean, so many gems in there. The first one I want to call out is you might be more brutal than I am ripping up resumes. I don't know, Ken.
I might be. Whenever I'm a jerk to people or what they perceive as a jerk, it's not, the intent isn't to be a jerk, right? I mean, sometimes you have to be a jerk, but the real intent is because cyber itself as a career, anything you do in cybersecurity, it can be very brutal. Like you're going to go into, especially as you evolve your career, you may go into boardrooms where you're getting cursed out, or executive meetings where they're calling you names and stuff like that. I mean, you need to prepare yourself for adulthood if you're one of those soft people out there. The other thing is I'm really, any feedback I ever give someone, whether you like it or not, it's real. I don't sugarcoat stuff. I'm not here to be your friend. I'm here to be, honestly, your advisor, right? If you're asking me a question, I'm your advisor. So I'm going to tell you like it is. I'm going to give you constructive feedback. I give people what I like to call the "you suck" sandwich. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
But you've never given it to me, so.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you just didn't know. But anyways, so those out there that don't know the "you suck" sandwich, basically when you're sitting down with someone, whether you're a manager or whatever, this is for anything in life, right? It could be in relationships, whatever. But basically you want to start off with something positive. So that, you know, the bread of the sandwich, right? Or if you don't eat bread, if you're gluten-free, whatever, just deal with me on this one for a minute. The bread of the sandwich, and those two slices of bread, that's your, you know, your friendliness, right? You know, something of value, like, hey, Tia, you did a great job on that project. I really liked, you know, how motivated you were. You had some really good ideas, et cetera, right? And then you move into asking a question, basically. Ask them, you know, was there anything you thought you could improve, Tia, right? So that's kind of getting in the condiments, if you will, of the sandwich, you know, lettuce, you know, whatever. And you know, they may say some things, they may not. You know, if they say the thing you were thinking of, then cool. You know, just like, hey, you know, yeah, you did pretty good on that, but maybe, you know, and move into the next part of it, the constructive criticism. If they don't say the thing you wanted or if they don't have any ideas, then move into, hey, you know, like I said, you did really good on these things. Here's a few things that I thought you could improve. And, you know, here's, you know, what I think, you know, on what might be a solution. Do you have any other ideas on how we might be able to solve this? So you always want to start with a positive. It's just human psychology. Honestly, if you, that's not really a soft skill, but I think that should be added to your list of things to really dig into. And there's some good books by Robert Caldani. I'll butcher the last name. Caldani. But forgive me, Robert, if that's not how you, Caldani or whatever. But basically look at Persuasion and, oh gosh, it's Influence, I think the other one he has. He's got several on Amazon. But human psychology, dig into that. But anyways, that's all the USEC sandwich is. It's just, you want to start off with something positive though, because people, it lowers your barrier. Just like a sales call, right? If you're doing sales, you want to start off with gaining rapport with the other person, however their personality is, right? Like Tia and I are pretty direct, but also laid back on a call. Other people are like very direct, you know, kind of military mindset, like you better tell me what you want right now. Other people will talk all day. They want to get to know you, blah, blah, blah. You know, it turns into a 4-hour sales call, but then you close the deal. So you have to gauge that, but that's really just establishing that rapport. And that's really all you're doing with that USUC sandwich. You kind of establish that rapport by finding something good that they did, something positive. There's always a positive in everything. And then from there, you work into what you wanted to help them improve. When you do it that way versus like a lot of managers out there will just be like, you're terrible. You did a terrible job on this. Like, you're not a leader, you're a manager when you do that, right? But you want to be a leader. And so the USUC sandwich is a good tool to do that. And you can do that also with your boss. You can be like, hey, I like that you, when you come around, you do give me, you know, suggestions and things like that. But what I don't like is, you know, really your approach on that. Do you think that, you know, would you, well, again, a little more negotiation stuff here, but would you be opposed to trying this way?
So Ken, we talked a lot about what individuals can do for themselves. We talked about certifications, education, thinking about soft skills. But from a leader perspective, is there anything security leaders can do to help their teams, you know, reach their best potential?
Yeah, I think number one, just setting realistic goals and expectations. Like I think an example I like to give is if someone's not good at, say, Python scripting, like don't think that just because you bought them some online course, you're going to be an expert in like 3 weeks. So I think really just setting those realistic goals for your team, like what are those milestones you really want them to achieve? And are they realistic for the individual, not just overall team? I think the other thing is identifying areas of interest. So people change interest all the time. Right now they might be one of your best SOC analysts, but maybe they want to get into pen testing or security engineering, or maybe GRC or something like that, or auditing. So identify those areas that they're interested in. For me, I used to do pen testing. People know me for pen testing. I created courses, things like that. And I don't really do that anymore. I do a lot of leadership things. I do a lot of things around sales, things like that. So I think just identifying those areas of interest for the individual and really recognizing how you can empower them. And then, of course, as a leader, you have to be mindful of your budget. Be smart with the budget. And, you know, there's training providers out there that, you know, for all intents and purposes, they charge what they should because it's very good training. But if you can only send like one or two people for the same amount as you could maybe get access to something for people for 6 months, or maybe you could bring in a special guest that can help your team learn a lot more in the shorter period of time or something like that. So just kind of be mindful of that budget of how can I maximize the budget for my team while at the same time making sure that they have the quality education or support that they need. And then I think the last thing I'll add is just focusing less on collecting certs for the team, unless that actually drives value for the individual as well as the overall organization, and focus more on the hands-on part of how you can, like, what skills did they have an interest in, and also what skills can be a contributing factor to the success of the organization. Sometimes those might be different things. So don't just be collecting certs or having people collect certs. Yes, that gives them a baseline knowledge, but at the end of the day, it's what can you actually do? George McPherson says it best, don't just be a piece of paper. So don't focus so much on certs over other things that might be a better priority for you to focus on.
Yeah, I love that that's your position. You know, sometimes I talk to security leaders or read articles about security leaders concerned about scaling their teams up because it's such a competitive market and they're scared they're going to train them up and they're going to leave. But if you don't train them up, then, you know, your organization is at risk just due to things that they're not aware of. So I always like to take the approach of, you know, skill your folks up to the point that they can leave, but make sure you have a culture that makes them want to stay.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think here in the U.S., people have that mindset. If you treat people well, like you said, a good culture, I think also when people get above usually a minimum of 75,000 base salary here in the U.S., and really if they hit six figures, at that point, unless they're really bad with money, but at that point, they usually will focus on everything else versus just base salary. So I think that's the point where that culture really, really takes effect, where maybe you can't pay someone 150 grand or 200 grand a year, but maybe you can pay them 130, but they know that they'll get off, you know, five or six every day to go see the family and eat dinner with them. So that's a big factor, especially as I evolved, even with my own businesses, I've closed a lot of things. I've sold a lot of things because I've recognized that I don't want to be going 24/7 anymore, right? I'm at the stage in my life where I'm just like, hey, I just want to enjoy life. You know, I feel like I might be missing the ride a little bit, right? So I think that people's priorities pivot a lot when they get a certain level of financial compensation. And that's where really the culture can lock people in place and they'll be with you. I mean, not forever, but it's very unlikely they'll leave. So I think that, yeah, that mindset, that's a mindset issue that a leader, that a manager or leader has, if they think that, oh, I train them up, they're going to leave. Because a lot of times the people that do leave, they realize the other side isn't greener, it sucks, and they come back. And now they've still got the skills. So now you're benefiting from those skills. So I think it's just a mindset thing people have to get over of thinking that, oh, I trained somebody up, they're going to leave. I mean, if that's the case, then fast food restaurants would never train anyone. Because, oh, I'm training them up, they're going to leave. Well, yeah, I did leave Burger King because it sucked, but I didn't take those skills anywhere that I learned there. I didn't go to somewhere else and make a Whopper. So I think it's just a mindset issue people have to get over out of their own head. They have to get out of their own head.
Yeah, I agree. So I want to switch gears a bit. You know, I talk to a lot of individuals that say, I'm applying for these cybersecurity jobs, but the job descriptions are crazy. They want 10 years of experience on platforms that have only been around for 2 years. So my question to you is, you know, what do organizations and cyber recruiters need to get right when they're hunting for talent, or do you think they have realistic expectations?
Well, yeah. So I think we all know that the expectations you see in job descriptions are just, number one reason is because everyone copies everyone else usually. So like there's somebody writes a bad job description and then somebody else copies that one, then somebody else. And then when someone in the organization you want to work at, they just go like search for it and they're like, oh, these are the things they need. And they pull them all together. And now you've got 72 things they want in a job description for 14 different cybersecurity careers for one role that's paying minimum wage. So I think, you know, you see that a lot out there. The first thing I'll say on that is, well, I think we'll probably talk about job candidates in a bit so we can segment these out a little bit. So for organizations and cybersecurity recruiters, so hiring managers, HR, whatever, understand that when you list out a laundry list of skills like that, if you find anyone that meets the majority of those, you're going to be paying out the wazoo, as I call it, for them. Your maximum dollar, you're going to eat up your entire budget. You're just going to be very sad. And guess what? They're going to leave in less than 6 months because somebody else is going to be a bigger company and they're going to pay them even more and they're going to steal them away from you. So it's just a waste of your time to post that laundry list of skills. It honestly is. Figure out what are those must-have skills that you absolutely need somebody to come in with or at least have an idea of so then you can send them to training immediately and get them skilled up on those things. But really, it's identifying what's the must-have skills and then also what are those nice-to-haves? Because honestly, there's probably 3 to 5 must-have skills in any job description I've ever seen. And there's like 9,000 nice-to-haves in the job description. So really, if you're writing job descriptions, like really identify, dig into like, okay, day one, what do I need them to absolutely have or it's a deal breaker? And that list better be 5 or less. If it's not 5 or less, you better keep going that list, working that list until you get 5 or less. And then from there, okay, everything else is a nice to have. It'd be great if they have that. So that way, when you write the job description, you put must have these things and you know you don't have to budge on that, right? If someone doesn't have these, sorry, we can't take you in. but everything else would be a preferred skill, right? Like, hey, it'd be great if you had these things too. And that will help you get a lot better talent, because then people will be like, oh, okay, I just need to really hone in on these skills if I want to work at that company. The other thing I might suggest is you upskill people at your own company. So if you've got people that you're planning to lay off, maybe give them the option where you can upskill them. Sure, there's a little delay in filling the role, but let's be real. A lot of you companies out there have so many hurdles to jump through. Like, your hiring process is like 6 to 12 months anyways. So if you're going to be waiting 6 to 12 months to get someone in, why not just take someone in the company that's already bought into the company mission and just upskill them through training and mentorship into the role? Then they already know your systems. It's a lot easier to just train up internal talent, and usually much cheaper as well. So I think that's another option for those hiring managers, organizations, and recruiters out there to explore. And then the last thing I'll add for those individuals is, I think working with some of these programs out there, whether it's boot camps or colleges or whatever, you know, if you've got training programs in your area where you have like headquarters or something like that, talk to them. Say, hey, we'd like to work with you. We'd like to figure out something where it benefits both of us, where you take, you know, our internal, maybe it's internal talent, right? You take our internal talent and we want to upskill them. Can you take your program and tailor it to our organization? And that way we get the people we need with the right skills and everything tailored to, you know, our organization. So I think it's just really just being open to these things, being open to exploring these things. But if you're not open to any of that, upskilling internal talent and working with these training programs, then at least please figure out the five absolutely must-have skills, put those in the job description, and then list everything else as a nice to have, because you're just a lot of people that I talk to that have a lot of the skills you're looking for in a job description, they don't feel comfortable applying for the job because they don't feel like they have all the requirements. So you're losing out on the talent that would probably be the best for your organization by listing that laundry list of like, oh, you better have all these things. And to your point, Tia, like, actually learn, like, Google, please, if you're not technical, Google search the technology so you know when it came out. If you want 96 years of Kubernetes experience, it's not going to happen. Nobody has that. If you want, I mean, any of these things, right? Golang. I mean, I've seen some really crazy things. I'm like, what the heck? Especially if you follow anyone on Twitter, you'll see these things, because they make memes out of them. But like, honestly, just like it takes 5 minutes to Google search and see that, oh, this technology came out 5 years ago, so we can only get somebody with maybe 5 years, 3 to 5 years experience on it, right? Or something like that. So yeah, it's really just goes back to, honestly, that boils to the fundamentals of writing job descriptions. You know, things I think people just, you know, now you can copy and paste. Back in the day, you had to do the work. So I think that's my spiel on organizations, recruiters, hiring managers. That's my advice for them.
No, that's good stuff. And I mean, to your point around doing the work, I think some of the challenge associated with writing an appropriate job description is what it takes to know what that should look like, because that forces security leaders to really evaluate their security programs and understand the type of talent that they need, the structure of that team, you know, the functions that the individuals are going to perform when they bring them on board. And some security leaders haven't done that, whether it's they don't have time, they don't know where to start. But that is where your job descriptions start fundamentally. So if you haven't done that work, then I don't know how you can write a meaningful job description so anyone will know what their day-to-day is going to look like when they join your team. So
exactly. That's why you see 24 PhDs, you know, CISSP, CISM, all that for an entry level.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Incredible. So let's pivot to the candidates then. You know, you and I recently co-authored Hack the Cybersecurity Interview with Chris Foulon. Tell us a bit about the book and your top 2 to 3 tips for cyber practitioners.
Yeah, so the book itself is really the book that, number one, I conned Tia and Chris into doing it because I didn't want to write the entire thing myself. So I socially engineered them into co-authoring the book. But phenomenal book. It's really a book that all of us wish we had starting out. There's no fluff. We didn't put fluff in the book. It's just like, if you were sitting with one of us, this is the advice we're going to give you. Like, we're not going to tell you the story of our lives or all that fluff you normally find in books that extend them out to 10,000 pages where no one reads them. So really the book's just breaking down different roles a little bit, giving you some expectation on salary, at least here in the US, and some things to keep in mind. And some of the questions you'll be asked in an interview, a lot of them are verbatim of questions though all of us have been asked over the years. There's a section in there on behavioral interview questions. So a lot of those are also pretty similar verbatim questions as we've been asked over the years. There's a chapter, that last chapter of the book, has a lot of our tips in there. And then early chapter is kind of really getting your mindset right for interviews and stuff like that. You know, tips from the book itself, I will say that a number one tip is actually writing out what you want to happen in the interview as if it's happened prior to the interview. It's such a distressor, and a lot of people get in their own head. They're like, that's not going to work. But just about every person I've talked to that's done it, it's worked for them. Like, they've gotten a job offer. And for those that didn't, usually the next time they did it, they got a job offer. So it's, I think we've had, I think we're over 100 people now, Tia, that have gotten job offers after using the stuff we put in the book. So shameless plug there. Like, people are using it and actually getting the jobs they want. And that's not just entry level people either. This is people that have experience too doing that. So I think that's one tip from the book, is just writing out what you want to happen before you go in, as if it's already happened. And I think it's really a distressor, right? People get so much anxiety going into an interview, but if you've written it out and you're like, well, that's what's going to happen, you're totally relaxed at that point. You know, of course you still prepare and things like that, but you're totally relaxed when you go in there. And now it's really like you're having a conversation with a friend, as opposed to a hiring manager or something. I think the other thing I'll just share is the slide deck thing that's in the book that we mentioned in the book, where you prepare a slide deck in advance. And this is like a gold mine thing. And I don't know why a lot of people don't do it, but prepare a slide deck, try to figure out like how that role you're applying for fits into the overall organization, you know? So whether it's fitting into the security posture or how it benefits the organization and some of the things they're trying to do, or the industry that they're in or whatever, just identify some problem that position will contribute to solving at a bigger scale than just on your team. And then from there, the next three slides are talking about your 30, 60, and 90 day plans of how you're going to contribute to solving, you know, whatever that thing is, or how you're going to help, you know, whatever that vision or mission is. And then the last slide is just listing out a couple of your key skills that you have, could be soft skills that mesh up with achieving that stuff, right? And then of course your contact information and whatever. That is so huge, and so many people just like never do it. I'll give you an example, and I need to reach out to her to see if she accepted the job offer, but a young woman used that recently with an organization for a role that honestly they wanted someone with experience for, and she's totally brand new. But she used that technique and they were wowed in the interview when she pulled out the slide. She's like, hey, can I share this slide deck? They're like, what? You know, so it works very well. It's just, you know, little things like that. And of course, doing your research. I think that's for me as a hiring manager, I would say the number one issue over the years is people don't research. I've had people come in and be like, what company is this again? I'm like, why are we? I literally told them, I was like, there's no point in us doing this interview because I will never hire you. Well, why not? I'm really good. I can do it. I'm like, you don't even know where you are. Like, you walked in the door past the signs and you don't even know where you are. There's no point. So do your homework, do your research. And it's not just researching, oh, I know the name of the company, Ken, I'll get in. No, you have to do your research. And again, try to figure out, like, how does this role fit into the overall organization? And what is this organization trying to do? What's their security posture now? Can you find that out? Can you talk to people within the organization? You might find people on the team. Guess what? If you find people that's on that actual team that you want to apply for the job on, and you talk to them, you network with them, now you have an insider, right? Not insider threat, but insider friend to actually go in, and you're like, hey, I'm applying for the job. And they'll be like, hang on a second, apply through this link. Cause a lot of companies, you know, offer the incentive to their employees to find people. So now they're going to get some money out of the deal. Plus they're going to walk over to the hiring manager and say, hey, Tia's applying for the job right now. She's really cool. I know her from LinkedIn. She's really good. Bring her in for an interview right away. And they're going to keep pestering their hiring manager till they bring you in for an interview. So instead of you being someone that is just a name, you know, just a random person, right, that's coming in for an interview, now you're somebody that knows Chris Follin, right, on the team. And now that goes a lot further. And now you're more likely, probably at 90% increase in your chances of getting a job offer on the spot in that interview, where you didn't have that before. So that OSINT you do, that research you do, is just so valuable. And I think just so many people, going back to what we talked about earlier about the sense of entitlement and the instant gratification that's prevalent nowadays, I think people just don't do that. And so if you do that, like, you can, I mean, back in the day, sure, researching in advance did separate you from other candidates, but a lot of people researched back in the day in advance of interviews. A lot of people don't nowadays. So you can just, like, you may not have all the skills they want, but you did your research. Now you fit into the organization. They say you fit into the culture now because you're actually show you want to be there. So I think research is probably the, if you take nothing else away from this recording that we're doing, research, do your research on the companies. That's going to go so far in the interview for the organization. It's also going to help you when you're trying to get an interview, because then you'll be able to contact people that work at the organization, network. And then from there, like I said, you have the internal champion that will go to the hiring manager or HR or somebody and say, hey, bring this person in for an interview. Then your resume that everyone worries about, oh, what font and all this worthless stuff. For all the resumes writers out there, I love you. You know, people that do that, whatever. I love you, right? Great. No hate. But let's be real. The resume rarely gets you a job interview. It's your networking, your personal branding that gets you in there. And that all starts, honestly, with doing the research, doing your homework. So that's all I have to say on that. That's some of the tips. I guess the other, I don't think I shared this in the book, but another tip I have is actually, if possible, ask them what the last interview spot of the day is and take that one. Because there's a concept called recency bias, where you'll be the last person they remember. And especially if you really wow them, now you're definitely the person they remember. They'll forget about Ken in the early morning. They'll remember Tia, right? They'll remember Tia at the end of the day. So that's, I guess that's the last piece of advice I'd share for a job candidate out there.
No, that's all great advice. And as you were talking through that, I thought back to your earlier point around sales and marketing, because I like to say every call is a sales call. And just like when you go to a car dealership and they want you to be able to see yourself in that car, right? You want recruiters, hiring managers, whoever it is you're working with to get your foot in the door, you want them to be able to see you on their team. So it's fantastic, Ken. Okay, so last question. If you had a billboard for cybersecurity, what would you put on it?
It's easy. It's three words. Tia is amazing. Easy. So if it actually had to be around cybersecurity, that's actually a tough question. What would you put? I would actually just put, let me ask this. Can I have a picture on there too? Or is it just words?
It's yours.
Oh, create a genius going. So I would actually put a picture of Larry in accounting and just have him looking sad and have someone screaming at him on the billboard and say, don't be like Larry in accounting. Don't click it. And that's it. That's it. You know, maybe a website link or something to whatever I want them to go to. So that's it. Something sad. But honestly, if I had a choice, Tia is amazing, because that would lead to more clicks to whatever website.
I love it. I'm going to go with don't be like Larry.
There you go.
Hey, Ken, thanks for joining us. This has been great. So if our listeners want to keep up with you, what you're working on, find you out there in the wide world, where can they find you?
Yeah, so you can go to cyberlife.tv, so cyberlife.tv as in television, and you can find everything there. You can find the training stuff. You can find the CyberLife School link there. You can watch the TV show. There's a link there, and then some episodes I had put on YouTube as well, and so those are embedded on the website. But yeah, you can find everything there. You can also track me down on LinkedIn. Just search for Tia's Fanboy, and if that doesn't work, try Ken Underhill, and you'll find me there as well.
Ken, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. My pleasure. Had a blast.
Yeah. Well, folks, that's a wrap for another episode of Cyber Talks. I'm Tia Hopkins. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you next time.